Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The New York Times has a name for it. It's called the I Can't Believe I'm a Hawk Club. A growing posse of lefties both at home and abroad who are being or have been swayed by the argument that war with Iraq may be the best thing after all. We've read the tortured op-ed checklists. Iraq, reasons not to attack, and reasons to attack. For some columnists, Colin Powell's audiovisual evidence did the convincing. For others, it was the weapons inspector's reports and the creeping sense of déjà vu all over again with Saddam Hussein. Connection listeners, what about you? Have you been persuaded that Saddam Hussein is a menace big enough to warrant sending in the soldiers? Or are you among those who have not and never will change your mind? This hour, we present a special transatlantic version of our program. We're linking up with the Simon Mayo Show in London, and we're being carried on the BBC's Radio 5 Live. That means we'll have callers from across the UK as well as the United States, and we'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And now to London.
8 minutes past three. Then in the UK, this is Simon Mayo on 5 Live, joining up with WBR in Boston and programme host Dick Gordon. Dick, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Hello, Simon, and welcome to The Connection. Welcome to the United States.
Well, it's nice to be a part of your programme. It's nice to be live in Boston. You're live across the entire United Kingdom. And one of the things we want to look at, I think, Dick, is the people who've recently changed their mind. Listeners in the UK have just heard some words from my guest here, Paul McGuinness, who's just changed his mind. Introduce us to your guest, who I think has changed his mind as well.
That's right. I have Timothy Noah with us here. Not exactly here. He's joining us from the NBR studios in Washington, D.C. Timothy is known as Chatterbox. He writes the Chatterbox column for Slate.com. And Timothy, about 2 weeks ago, you decided that you weren't exactly going to stick with your opposition to the war. What happened?
Well, yes, I had previously been opposed to the war. I felt that it was a needless distraction from the war against Al-Qaeda, which is how I've always characterized it, not the war on terrorism, because I don't think you can fight an abstraction. But Colin Powell's speech turned me around. He provided such overwhelming evidence that Iraq was in material breach of the UN resolution that was passed a few months ago, that I really felt that the time has really come for us to either put up or shut up.
Timothy, this is Simon for BBC Radio 5 Live in London here. So you think it was the evidence that Colin Powell actually presented, that was your Damascus Road experience in terms of converting you to a hawk?
Yes, not that it was such an extraordinary surprise to me that the evidence was there, but I felt that with the United States and, by extension, the UN going so public with this evidence, that the credibility of the United States and the UN were at stake if they didn't follow through on the UN resolution. This resolution is being very explicitly breached by Iraq, and we have made a great issue of it. The UN has made a great issue of it, and I think that we can't let Iraq flout that.
Okay, Dick, let me introduce you to Paul McGuinness, Guardian journalist, indecisive Guardian journalist. You've read his stuff, I think.
Why I Won't Be Marching was the last thing that you wrote just before the weekend, Paul. Now, what happened?
I got up and I marched.
Which means that you have now changed your mind. You're against the war, or what?
Like I was saying, I've probably changed my mind a dozen times. I think over here, people look at things very differently from the way you do it in the States, and obviously there are important reasons for that, September the 11th. I think with my feeling about war is that it's not that Saddam isn't an evil man. It's not that maybe he might be a threat to the region or maybe even to ourselves. I think it's about whether we can stop him from being a threat, whether we can disarm him without the use of force. And my feeling about Colin Powell's presentation was that that just further showed that what was actually happening was that inspectors were unsettling Saddam's regime, and that by reinforcing the inspectors by, you know, whatever the French is, they want 20 times as many, 50 times as many, and twice as many, just putting more inspectors on the ground, giving them better information, letting Saddam know that we know he's up to tricks, I think actually might stand a real chance of getting a result.
Now, if you're calling in the UK, it's 08700 100 500. In the US, 1-800-423-8255. Jeff in Enfield, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi there.
OK, live in the UK and around the States as well. What do you want to say, Jeff?
Oh, my God, America as well. Right, I was in favour of going to war, although very, very reluctantly. I don't think dropping bombs on people is a very friendly thing to do. But I was very, very reluctantly in agreement in the beginning. Although I was really concerned about the effect this might have on the population. But as soon as I heard that document, so-called evidence of Tony Blair's, was a forgery, and that's what it was. It was a forgery. I almost immediately changed my mind, and I suddenly realised, hang on a minute, we're going to start dropping tons of ordnance on top of people because of something that's actually not true. We're in fact no better than they are. If we can use propaganda, the way in which Tony Blair has used propaganda in order to convert us into believing that this is a just war, then we are in the wrong. Now, when it comes to Iraq
Jeff, it's Dick Gordon here in Boston. I wonder if I can just interrupt and ask. So Tony Blair has been making a very persuasive case in his speeches. What is it about that one document that persuaded you that perhaps the case for war was not strong?
It's not just that one document in itself. It's the fact that it's a whole ambiance of the way in which he's put the thing forward to us. If he's proved to be to use the document, and in fact it was a forgery, as I understand it was some undergraduate's thesis from about 10 or 12 years ago, some American student, and he's used that and twisted it into making it look as if it's evidence. So what else is not true?
You ought to say, Jeff, that...
What else is
Tony,
not true? What,
Tony
how
Blair,
else is he lying to
Jeff,
us? Tony, how else is he... I mean,
Jeff, Tony Blair...
Name,
Jeff, Tony
finished.
Blair has said that the facts in that report were true.
He said.
They've admitted that they should have acknowledged that it was a student's report, but that the facts were right.
Well, he said that, but he used the student's report and put it forward to us as if it was his own investigation. And the fact is, we have to understand that you're in America, with respect, you're in America, you don't know what's been going on here, that here is a man, a prime minister, who's set something like 20 or 30 targets in the 6 years he's been in power and not yet met one single one of them. A man who refuses to answer questions in Parliament, in fact, often refuses even to turn up to a debate in Parliament, a man who actually cannot be trusted. And here he is put a document forward as evidence that we should go for reasons for which we should go for war, and it turns out to be a forgery. And I'm sitting here thinking, hang on a minute, I don't believe you.
Jeff, just hang on for half a second if you can.
Please let me make this point.
All right.
Please allow me to make this point.
The
fact is that with Iraq, they're really no longer a great danger to the world because they know, Saddam knows, if he steps one foot out of line, America and Israel will flatten him. So he dares not use any of this stuff that he probably
has got in the
way.
It would have been nice talking to you, Jeff, when you were for the war. It would be nice to have heard your version of events there. Dick, over to you.
Let's bring in Michael, who's joining us now from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael.
Yes, hello.
Welcome.
Hi. I just can't shake the overwhelming feeling that this administration needs a war in Iraq, that Saddam was a pre-vilified target. You know, there was no need to have a massive propaganda campaign or even truth-telling campaign to convince Americans that it would be a good idea to attack him. And there's an excluded middle. If we were really interested in getting rid of their weapons of mass destruction, we'd have concentrated on anything which would have diminished their capability to do that instead of talking about full-scale war, which has many other uses, the stifling of dissent, the ability of an administration to get over the rest of its policies, just because I believe they have a wonderful hammer, and so they're looking desperately for a nail.
Michael, just take a break for a minute. I want to bring Timothy Noah in as well, because Timothy, it's that suspicion about the motivation of the administration that has so many people ambivalent about whether or not they should support the war or not.
That's right, and suspicion obviously on both sides of the Atlantic. speaking to the British document, I think forgery really is not the correct word to use. It
plagiarism.
Was plagiarism. And that has been acknowledged. And, you know, obviously it was wrong for the British government to plagiarize. an academic paper. However, the facts in it do appear to have been true. And in fact, The New Yorker ran an article a couple of weeks ago complaining that intelligence agencies don't pay enough attention to publicly available sources, that they don't get a complete picture. You do get a sense that they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. On the United States side, I can't buy that the Bush administration has sort of purely diabolical motives for getting involved in this war.
I'm sure they think they're wonderful people for wanting to change this regime, and it's a terrible regime, but just because evil people are running a government, it doesn't mean you start a war. Just because something is a danger to society, it doesn't mean that you pass a law against it. Not all problems require the solutions that have been put forward. I believe that in this case, as in others, the solutions that are put forward have other important elements. The administration, for example, has this, to me, nearly masturbatory fantasy of changing the entire Middle East by sending in troops and taking out Saddam.
Michael, thank you very much for your call. You're listening to a program which is going out on BBC Radio 5 Live in the UK and also linking up with WBUR in Boston. The UK's number 08700 100 500 in the US 1-800-423-8255. Joey in Taunton, good afternoon and good morning in the American version. Joey, what do you have?
Good afternoon. Yeah, I was going to say that up until the weekend, I was erring towards war, but really a little bit undecided. After listening to the speeches at that march, I became totally in favour. It's pushed me more the other way. To me, it was like people being conned onto the pacifist agenda.
Explain a bit more. What was it or who was it that you heard on the anti-war rally that converted you?
The likes of Tony Benn, where it became apparent they weren't just opposed to this sort of war, they were opposed to any sort of war. I mean, 1939, they'd have had us billions out there opposed to a war with Germany.
Paul McInnes with me in the studio, Guardian journalist. You went on the march. Did you share any of Joey's doubts having been on it?
I shared them entirely. I mean, I like to consider myself, slightly left-leaning myself, but at any of these occasions you go to, there is always going to be bandwagon jumping going on, and people who use other people's kind of uncertainties or feelings to their own end. And I think that's when you had the march on Saturday was explicit on the leaflets. It said no war in Iraq and freedom for Palestine. And however you feel about the issue in Israel and Palestine, it is something that's separate and cannot be discussed under the same banner.
Don't get me wrong. I believe the situation in the Middle East with Israel has to be sorted out. I also believe that Saudi Arabia is as much a tin pot dictatorship as anybody else in the region. I wouldn't deny that at all. But when I listened to Tony Blair as well after that, and I've listened to his speech again today, my view on the war now is that a war will cost lives. I accept it. But I'm coming to the view that in the long term, it will probably save more lives.
Joey, thank you. Dick, I've got a question for you here from Richard in High Wycombe. He wants to know what your listeners would think of the French position regarding Iraq. He says, I believe a great many people in this country are shocked by the level of invective aimed at them from across the Atlantic.
We actually did a program where we brought together the French and the American perspective and explored some of the history of that, Simon, and it doesn't just begin with this particular issue, that there is quite a long history of animosity between the two and the French looking for an opportunity to be heard, to count, to make a difference on this. Certainly, there has been talk of boycotts and that sort of thing, but still, because no final decision's been made, people are still looking to make their own. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. You're listening to a special co-production of The Connection from WBUR Boston and NPR and The Simon Mayo Show on BBC 5 Live. With us in the program today, Timothy Noah writes the Chatterbox column for Slate.com. Paul McInnes is assistant editor of Guardian Unlimited and a writer for The Guardian newspaper. My name's Dick Gordon, and joining us from the studio in London is Simon Mayo. Simon.
Yes, we have the world's most indecisive columnist here. But I wonder, Dick, whether actually when Paul says he can't make up his mind, whether actually he's speaking for millions and millions of people who see righteousness on each side.
Well, Timothy, you must get that kind of feedback at Slate.com.
Yes, we're kind of all over the map on the war at Slate. And and one of our columnists has pronounced himself indefinitely indecisive. There are strong arguments on both sides. I still think the argument this may interfere with the war against al-Qaeda is a powerful one. I just think that it's overwhelmed by the argument that the international community has rendered an ultimatum, and if it doesn't follow through, then it won't be able to have much credibility in the future. And I think it needs that credibility.
Let's talk to Nancy in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hello, Nancy.
Hello.
Hello. Good afternoon. Good morning to you. What do you want to say? Are you a waverer?
Yes, I was. I've always been in favor of a peaceful means and, you know, the most legal and multilateral solutions to problems of an international sort. I'm definitely wouldn't regard myself as a Bush supporter, and I was completely against Desert Storm. However, one of the things that's really made me think twice is that perhaps even if it's just posturing, perhaps that's working. You know, the fear of an actual war and an attack on Saddam Hussein has possibly made his people think twice.
But if you threaten, doesn't that mean, Nancy, that at some point you might have to deliver on the threat?
Yes, that's one of the things that I dislike the most, and that's the main reason why I don't want to march against the war, because I think it's the worst of all possible solutions, but sometimes those things have to be done. I'm thinking of Chamberlain being against the Second World War, and you know, if that might have been nipped in the bud a lot sooner with less death and less destruction. You're dealing with a person who's crazy. I'm not going to say evil. Evil is a terrible thing. It's been an awful term that's been bandied about, and it's so stupid. It's a person who has hurt his people and appears to be a crazy person.
Nancy, I wonder if I can just get you to hang on for half a second. I'll remind our listeners you're listening to a joint production of The Connection from WBUR and NPR and The Simon Mayo Show on BBC 5 Live. Our number in the United States, 1-800-423-8255. The number in the UK, 08-700-100-500. Joining us now is Henry from Fleet. Hello, Henry.
Hi there. Hi. Yeah, I'd like to actually put my point across as well. I was a bit of a waverer prior to the war. I actually did started to go down towards the non-war route within the last couple of weeks. And essentially, it was since that document was released, there was actually a college thesis and then produced in the United Nations as a credible piece of evidence. But the thing that really changed my view on the war was essentially the politician Ken Livingstone's speech within the United Kingdom.
We ought to say, Henry, that Ken Livingstone is the mayor of London. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And essentially, he came up with a number of facts that I wasn't actually aware of. And what I've done is over the last couple of days, I've actually spent some time, gone back through as many history books as I can get hold of, and had a look, try to verify these facts. And essentially, they were, for example, who supplied the weapons to Saddam Hussein to actually fight the Kurdish army, who actually put Saddam Hussein within power, and then consequently, after Saddam Hussein became the leader of Iraq, who actually gave him the weapons and the money to actually turn around and fight the Kurdish army and get rid of those out of Iraq. I mean, essentially, it just seems to me that everything is half-truths. We're being given half-truths. And yes, I do agree, we are dealing with persons.
Nancy in North Carolina, see if you can convert Henry in Fleet. He wasn't sure about the war. He went to the big march in London. You might have seen pictures of that. We think it was the biggest demonstration ever in the UK, 1 million, 2 million, depending on who you talk to. But Nancy, you're in Greenboro. Talk to Henry in Fleet, see if you can make him change his mind.
I don't know if I can make him change his mind. I mean, I've been wavering back and forth. I don't know which is the best way to go. And, you know, certainly we've backed up administrations that haven't been fair and haven't been right. I think one of the things that made me think about it again was a young woman, I believe she's in Great Britain studying, who was on either yesterday or the day before, and she had said that she was, in Iraq when Desert Storm occurred, and that the people there were happy because they thought finally that they'd get rid of the administration that they have. I was trying to
Nancy, I think you're absolutely right. I think that the world does need to get rid of Saddam Hussein as the leader of Iraq. I think that the problem that George Bush has basically backed himself into is essentially he's turned up with all of his forces, and he has threatened to do something militarily. But this is not the only solution. It's just so frightening to me to listen to people who think that the only solution for this problem is to go to war with Saddam Hussein, where you're going to kill innocent people. Yes, you might save people in the long run, but essentially you're killing people. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can see now, you're in a situation where George Bush has backed your entire country into a corner where he has threatened another country and said, look, we're going to kick ass if we need to. And he's now in a situation where he can't back away from that. Everybody knows that this is not just about getting rid of Saddam and saving the people of Iraq, because if that was the case, then we wouldn't have tried to kill the people of Iraq in the last so many decades.
Henry, it's Dick Gordon here in Boston. I wonder if I can just step in, say thanks to Nancy for calling in and bring Paul into the conversation. Paul's joining us from York, Maine. Hi, Paul.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you so much for this program and for taking my call. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I served in the Navy during the Vietnam War, and I was, as they say, to the right of Genghis Khan in those days. Over the years, though, I've had the opportunity to study some history and to listen to other points of view. When this conflict started, when especially 9/11, I supported military intervention in Iraq. But over subsequent months, I have come to profoundly oppose any military action there now, and I do so for the following reason. No one's hands are clean in the Middle East. Not the United States, not Israel, not Iraq, not Saudi Arabia, not anybody. This is a turning point for civilization, in my opinion. When all the nations of the world, especially the strong, must abandon the use of violence and militarism to solve political disputes. So I profoundly oppose this venture in Iraq.
Paul, this is Simon in London here. Can I ask you whether your view is shared by many Vietnam vets?
Yes, a surprising number. I think the Vietnam War for us in this country, especially the vets, was a turning point too, because we're starting to reevaluate our history, really going all the way back, I should say, perhaps even to the First World War, but especially where Vietnam and even to some extent Korea are concerned. We're having second thoughts about that, doubts about, and we're worried, I must say also, about what's emerging in with regard to North Korea and how the United States seems to be planning to handle that as well.
Paul, thank you very much indeed for your call. This is Simon May in London. We will continue in the UK with our news and sport. We'll be back with our Boston friends in just a moment. We're doing a link-up with WBUR in Boston. Dick Gordon is the host of the program there. If you'd like to speak, they go right across the US. They're based in Boston, but they're broadcast across the United States. This is a time for a lot of people to listen to what you have to say. 08700 100 500. We'll take some news and sport.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I am Dick Gordon. With me in Washington, Timothy Noah, who writes the Chatterbox column for Slate.com. And while the folks in the London studio take a very brief break to catch up on news and sports there, Tim, perhaps just a chance to reflect on the caller who said that Bush has taken this so far that he's not going to be able to back down in any way, that the war is inevitable by virtue of the force that's there in the Gulf and the threats that have been uttered by the administration?
Well, no, I don't think war is entirely inevitable. It is still possible. I think there's a very slim chance of it, but it is possible that that Saddam Hussein will respond to the threat by fully disarming. But I have to say, I expect that won't happen and that there will be war. A couple of the earlier callers talked about how nobody's hands are clean and how the United States has supported Saddam in the past. That's true. And particularly during the Iran-Iraq war, the Reagan administration tilted towards Iraq. Mm-hmm. There's a famous picture of Donald Rumsfeld, now the defense secretary, who was then an emissary from the U.S. government, shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. That looks very ironic today. But I don't think that fact necessarily points in the way of saying we should stay out now. This is, I think it helps convey the idea that this is a mess that is partly of our making, and if we have the ability to undo it, perhaps we should. I don't think that's the principal reason for going to war, but I don't see the historical objection as carrying much weight.
And is it your view that the United States then could, in some fashion, say we've changed our mind and pull all the forces out? I mean, I don't actually see how the administration could back down, given the volume of material and people that are there now.
Only in the case of full and unquestionable disarmament,
right,
on the part of Saddam Hussein. One thing that Colin Powell, I think, conveyed very powerfully that I neglected to mention before was the futility of the inspections process. That mm-hmm. was a major theme of his speech. And I have to say he did persuade me of that. It's a bit of a farce. Inspectors show up. The Iraqis get advance notice. They shift things out of the way. This could go on for years. And it seems especially pointless when we already know from various satellite photos and intercepted conversations that Iraq has chemical and biological weapons. I don't think there's any ambiguity about that. We also talked earlier about why are people so angry at France, and I think it's because they've denied that.
You're listening to BBC Radio 5 Live. It's 3:34. Simon Mayo till 4 o'clock, linking up with WBUR in Boston and program host Dick Gordon. If you're calling in the UK, 08700 100 500. In the US, 1-800-423-8255. Dick, I wonder if I could ask you and Timothy Noah, your guest there, to sort of sum up American public opinion. Certainly from the UK's point of view, you could say that support for the war is extremely flimsy. All the polls suggest that certainly without a second UN resolution, the Prime Minister might take maybe 9%. That's just 9% of people with him. But the support in the US is stronger.
Timothy, I think in many ways you need to look at the United States in geographical pieces to measure the support. If you talk about New England, you're talking about places where dozens of buses will go off to an anti-war protest in New York City, and that sort of opposition to the war is not as strong as you move west and south and into Republican territory.
That's right. And overall, polls have shown there is pretty strong support in the U.S. for war, with the caveat that people do seem to, I think, rightly want this to be a war declared by the United Nations, not the United States. My own belief is that if ultimately the United Nations does not declare war, that the United States should. But I am hoping that that won't have to happen. And I do think that we don't need to rush our diplomatic efforts in order to try and persuade the other members of the Security Council.
All right. Listeners in the United States, the number is 1-800-423-8255. In the UK, 08-700-100-500. You're listening to a joint broadcast of The Connection from NPR and the Simon Mayo Show on BBC Live 5. Let's bring in Andy, who's joining us now from Chester. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how you doing there?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that I used to be a serving member of the Royal Navy on submarines and used to chase Russians for a living. And as such, I'd go with the flow of the present government at the time. And I tended to go along with the government of this time and agree that, yeah, we should go to war and we should kick bad people out of their jobs and what they're doing, et cetera, et cetera. But some of the evidence that I've seen our government put forward to us to suggest that we should be going out and killing people is just frankly ridiculous. I can't believe that weapons inspectors are picking up empty shells and looking down them inside them with torches and saying, yes, these are chemical weapons and things like this. I just don't believe the evidence that's being put forward is saying to me, yep, valid war, let's go for it. And as such, I just want to change my mind and have nothing to do with this, you know?
Paul McGuinness, writer for Guardian Unlimited, we know you're indecisive, Paul. We've established that fact. Andy is not impressed. Andy is not impressed. He says the evidence is just not good enough.
I mean, I think that's perfectly right. I mean, I think.
Are you going to agree with everybody?
I think that everybody has something to say which is legitimate. And I think when you go back to Henry from Fleet earlier on, and I think he exemplified something that's typical in this country now, that everybody is, you're nigh on an expert on Iraq. Everybody has devoured newspapers, television. Gone home like Henry and done their own research to find out the truth of the matter and try and clarify their opinion. So when you do have people, the government's trying to persuade you, if their evidence isn't watertight, if their case isn't strong, then people aren't going to believe them.
So Paul, who do you trust here? Are you looking at the weapons inspectors for the?
Well, I mean, I think I do. I think I've more. I place more credibility in them strictly because they're on the ground. I mean, I do actually have a certain amount of faith in Tony Blair, and I think Tony Blair very much does believe that he is right in what he is doing. I just worry that he doesn't have any evidence stronger than what he's shown already.
Just on the question of the evidence, which is the one that Andy in Chester has mentioned, Timothy Noah, I wonder if you could address Andy's concern. He's happy to support the war, I think I'm right in saying, Andy, if the evidence is powerful. You were saying what converted you was Colin Powell's evidence when he was at the UN, try and impress Andy with those thoughts.
I think the evidence is overwhelming. And I'd sort of note that even Hans Blix has essentially declared Iraq to be in violation of the UN resolution because of some long-range missiles that they found. Going back to Colin Powell's evidence...
After a minute about those long-range missiles. They apparently only go 12 kilometres further than it says on the box. 13 kilometres further than it says on a box. I mean, big deal. You could swat them away with a fly swat. You know, it's pointless.
Well, again...
We went through a Cold War with the Russians for how long? And how many Russians did we kill? We pointed all our armaments at Russia and we said, try it, Ivan. Just try it. You know?
Let me proceed to Colin...
going and murdering people.
Let me proceed to Colin Powell's evidence. I mean, he had a number of satellite photos, only one of which was questioned by Hans Blix. He had a number of intercepted conversations. Let me repeat to you one of these conversations. You've got two officers talking to each other on the radio. One says, remove. The other says, remove. The expression. I got it. Nerve agents. Wherever it comes up.
I have to stop you there, Timothy. We're going to take a short break here at The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to a special presentation of The Connection from NPR and The Simon Mayo Show on BBC Five Live. This hour, a conversation about people who have and have not and are trying to decide whether or not they should change their minds about a war in Iraq. Timothy Noah is with us. He is in the Washington NPR studios. Paul McGuinness is with Simon Mayo on BBC Five Live in the studio there. And Simon, I'm interested in knowing, we look at the headlines and there's an EU joint declaration and Kofi Annan goes to the Vatican and there's the vote coming up in Turkey. But aside from everything that's in the newspapers, is this a question that people are asking themselves on the streets, in the hallways of the place where you work?
Yes, absolutely. I think more than any other political event that I can remember, even more so than the Gulf War in 1990 and 1991, more so than in the Falklands crisis as well in this country. I think this is something that is being talked about in pubs and clubs, and as Paula said, people are changing their minds. It is an obsessive issue. It's an enormous one. Let's pick up on a call here from Mohammed in Sharon in Massachusetts. Mohammed, good afternoon. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Yeah. The question I have really, I'm for peace, a peaceful way to settle problems, because war is ultimately, I believe, that it is a failure of human being, I mean, to be able to reach solutions in a civilized manner. However, I have been supporter of this war, this particular war. The reason, because I know Saddam Hussein, I know Ba'ath Party, I know what they have done, I mean, to their people, as well as to the Kurds. I am a Kurd from northern part of Iraq. They gassed us, but no one came to our help when Saddam Hussein gassed us. Now, the messages I hear from Washington, it is kind of vibrating, it's changing continuously. It doesn't come out as a coherent message saying that we are going to get rid of Saddam Hussein, we are going to put in a democracy in the country, we are going to liberate the people, Iraqi people. What they are saying, I mean, one day they are saying, well, we might have a coup there and replace Saddam Hussein with another army general.
It could well be, Mohammed, that they're casting about for a message that resonates with people. You know, what started as regime change became disarmament. Now that's what they're talking about. Stay with us if you can. I'd like to bring Gordon into the conversation. Gordon's called in from St. Albans. Hi, Gordon.
Hello.
Thank you for calling.
Hi. Hello.
What's your point, Gordon?
Hello. My point is that the whole conversation of those who are in favour of invading Iraq seems to be about human rights. And to my knowledge, there is nothing in the UN Charter about the right of any other country to invade another country over its internal human rights. Had there been that, we'd been invading America in the 1950s over its busing issues and segregation of black people. So we're not allowed to do that. So why are we talking about invading Iraq simply on the basis that he's not a very nice chap?
Mohammed,
so is it a question, Gordon, of international law as far as you're concerned?
Yeah.
Well, if it is international law, I don't see why the international law couldn't be changed by the major council members to make it in a way. I mean, if people, governments, or leaders, they are suppressing their people, murdering their own people, they should be able, I mean, to have a power to go in and change those governments, not to engage in a debate like what the United States is doing with the European countries and so on and so forth. But if they are going to go in to disarm Saddam Hussein of few weapons, they have already gotten rid of almost 90-95% of his weapons. He doesn't have very much left. If they are going in to disarm him and they're going to sacrifice a large number of American, British soldiers, as well as, I mean, thousands of Iraqis, I don't think it's worth it. But if they are going in to liberate the people of Iraq from further repression, I think that's worth it.
Mohammed in Massachusetts, thank you very much indeed for the call. Gordon in St. Albans, thank you. You're listening to 5 Live and WBUR in Boston. President Bush has been giving a press conference in the last few minutes. Let's talk to the BBC's Rob Watson in Washington. Rob, there may well be questions from Dick Gordon as well in Boston. But can you tell us what the president's been saying?
Yes, I can. And good afternoon and good morning to you all, depending where you are, of course. Well, a number of things, really. First of all, the president was asked about all these huge protests we'd seen, not just in the United States, but in Europe, indeed, and Asia and other parts of the world. And the president said, well, democracy is a beautiful thing, as he said, but people are allowed to say what they want. But he said he respectfully disagreed that Saddam had clearly defied UN resolutions, was a threat to the world, and therefore he was going to disarm Saddam Hussein, either with the help of the UN or without it. He was also asked about this issue of a second resolution, because earlier today at the White House, his spokesman had said that the US probably would push for a second resolution, either this week or possibly next week, a short resolution. And the president was asked, well, what about this second resolution? He said, well, we would certainly welcome it. It would be useful. But Saddam Hussein didn't seem to be very interested in the first resolution. That resolution already does, 1441, give us the authority to use force. So, yes, we'd like a second resolution, but it's not absolutely necessary. So that was it in the nutshell, really.
Rob, it's Dick Gordon here. I'm wondering, did the president say anything about timing? Because his officials, unnamed officials, have been quoted as saying that the White House was perhaps interested in another couple of weeks of diplomacy.
No, he didn't, Dick, but I think that's a traditional way that this White House operates, that the president is not in the habit of doing anything much beyond saying time is running out, the UN must live up to its responsibilities. He's not the one that hints at time frames, but certainly over the last few months of this crisis, it's always been officials behind the scenes saying time, this may be another couple of weeks, this or the other deadline is important, but the president himself did not set a deadline.
Let's hear from Tim Noah on this. Tim writes Chatterbox for Slate.com. And Tim, if the president is dismissing the millions of people who protested over the weekend, is that in keeping with the way he has reacted to the anti-war movement so far?
Well, he disagrees with the anti-war movement, and now I must say I disagree with it, too. I think the fact that there were demonstrations across the world, hopefully it will encourage the president to try and harder to work through the UN, and to that extent I think it's a good thing. But ultimately, I don't blame him for shrugging his shoulders and saying, I disagree. And obviously, a majority of people in the United States disagree as well.
Mm. Rob Watson in Washington, thank you very much indeed for your report this afternoon. I wonder, Paul McInnes, where this almost certain invasion of Iraq leaves the fight against terrorism. One of the reasons that many people give for not supporting a war against Iraq is the fact that the real threat that they feel is from al-Qaeda, and that this will just enrage Arab opinion further.
Well, I think it depends on how the war plays out and most importantly, what is done if Saddam's regime is toppled, what is done to replace it. I think people's while people find it very difficult to kind of associate the war on terror with the war in Iraq in terms of carrying it out, I think you can't underestimate the fear that kind of is in people at large about being the subject of a terrorist attack. And I think in turn that informs people's interest, people's opinions on the war. I think it's something that people will continue to be worried about and continue to be thinking about for a long time. And to be frank, I don't see politicians offering any kind of solution.
Okay, you're listening. Thank you, Dick.
Yes, you're listening to a special transatlantic broadcast of the Simon Mayo Show on BBC Five Live, The Connection on NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky, and bring Charles into the conversation. Charles, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Dick. How are you?
Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, I mean, I started out being opposed to a war because I questioned the motivations for it. And I think it's a situation gray in many ways. But I think that two things are clear. And I think that Hussein's track record speaks for itself. And that the fact that he does have weapons of mass destruction, whether those weapons are capable of doing direct damage to the United States, I think is an open question. But I think he's made it very clear what his intentions are for his neighbors based on what he did in Kuwait. And if he's allowed to go unchecked, you have to ask, where does that lead? And the second thing that I think is very clear is that the UN passed 16 resolutions in 10 years, and Hussein basically thumbed his nose at those resolutions, and it makes the credibility of the UN at stake. I'm opposed to the United States doing this unilaterally because I think that puts the U.S. in the position of being the world's unpaid policeman, and I don't think that's a good role for us to be in. But,
Charles, it's Simon here in London. How do you address those people who are against the war because they say, what I'm really committed to is the fight against terrorism, and this, in the long run, is going to create more of it?
Well, I don't know that it creates more terrorism. I think that I've heard all kinds of rhetoric about how it's going to open the jaws of hell, and I think back in 91 the expression was it was going to be the mother of all wars or whatever, and that was, you know, it was rhetoric and saber-rattling, and I think that, you know, Hussein has to be confronted, and he has to have his feet held in the fire, and the UN's credibility is at stake. As I said, there were 16 resolutions in 10 years, and if he's allowed to flout those resolutions, what can of worms does that open in terms of future actions by the UN? I think they render themselves meaningless, and it becomes, at some level, just a debating club, a debating society. But I'm opposed to war as a matter of principle. I think that it should not be a first resort, but I think you cannot take the military option off the table when you're dealing with somebody like Hussein, because it's probably, as a practical matter, the only way that's going to force him to comply, to get in line with the UN resolutions. And my guess is that he will ultimately back down. But he may be crazy enough to force a showdown that he can't possibly win. I mean, he may, just like Adolf Hitler, decide to take everything down in a and immolate his own country in a scorched earth policy, much like Hitler did in World War II.
Paul McInnes in London, it is that conundrum that the threat of force is what has brought Saddam Hussein as far along in terms of obeying the weapons inspections that the country has come so far. What happens when you take that threat away?
Well, I agree with you, and the important thing is to maintain that threat. The question that's already been asked before is, when do you get to the level of your threat actually having to turn itself into actual action?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure we've reached that. I'm not sure we've reached that point yet. As I say, I think there are real signs that the inspections policy is unsettling. It's unsettling Saddam. It's forced him into gestures such as the statement last week about not importing or exporting weapons of mass destruction that he previously hasn't made. And I think we can take further steps in making this inspection more rigorous. In, for example, the suggestion has been sending in UN troops to back up the inspections process that can keep on ratcheting up the level of threat. But yes, it cannot go on forever.
And Timothy Noah, you said at the beginning of our joint broadcast that you're a reluctant convert to war. Your president has spoken of a coalition of the willing, but everybody knows that there's no point of being in a coalition, you know, with the greatest respect to Morocco and Colombia. What you need is a coalition with the EU and a coalition with NATO. Are you a convert to war in any circumstances?
I am. I believe that if ultimately we can't get the UN on board, then the United States should go to war alone, and or not purely alone. Probably Great Britain would join us. But I do think that the administration should keep pursuing the diplomatic option. I have by no means given up hope that. That the NATO countries and the Europeans in general will support this war. I mean, the EU declaration seems to be edging a little closer to support for a war, although that isn't spelled out in the document. Yeah. I think that, people in the United States should not give up hope that that a UN force can be put together.
Now, we have to part ways here because the connection has to take care of some of its own business, and the Simon Mayo Show on BBC's 5 Live is wrapping up its program as well. So, Simon, I want to thank you for being a part of our program and ask that perhaps we get a chance to do it again sometime.
Well, I feel as though this story will be with us for quite a while yet. So maybe, Dick, that's a very good idea. Look forward to speaking to you again sometime.
Thanks so much. That's Simon Mayo, the host of the Simon Mayo Show on BBC 5 Live. Tim Noah, thanks so much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Timothy Noah writes the Chatterbox column for Slate.com, and Paul McInnes, an assistant editor at The Guardian Unlimited, is with Simon in the London studio. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation in our online forums. We are at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.